This is Healthy Rounds with Dr. Anthony Alessi. Sponsored by Hartford Healthcare, Rochford Eye Center, St. Francis Hospital, Covaris, and Yukon Health Orthopedics and Sports Medicine. Healthy Rounds provides general information regarding medical conditions and diseases. The information is not intended to create a doctor-patient relationship. You're encouraged to consult your own medical provider for advice that applies to your own medical care. And now, Dr. Anthony Alessi on WTIC News Talk 1080 and WTIC.com.
Welcome to Healthy Rounds, the show that provides you with up-to-date medical information and answers all of your health questions. I'm your host, Dr. Anthony Alessi, and it's great to be with you on this Saturday morning, October 26, 2024. And although we are nearing the end of the month, this has been Breast Cancer Awareness Month, and I always like to get a guest on to give us the updated information on breast cancer, the treatments for breast cancer, and whatever we are starting to learn and how statistics are moving. And to that end, we have my guest today will be Dr. Catherine Capasso. Kate Capasso is a board-certified general surgeon and specializing in breast cancer. She is at St. Francis Hospital. So we really want to drill down in some of the statistics we're hearing a lot about, especially with respect to the improvements we've made in survival of breast cancer, but an alarming feature that we're seeing more breast cancer in younger women. So we want to get a little bit more information about that so we can, as always, live our lives a little bit healthier. Later on today, I'll be on the sideline for UConn as the UConn football team takes on Rice. It should be a great day out there. The weather is perfect, and if you get a chance, get out there and watch the UConn Huskies play. As always, in the month of October, we're wearing pink to some degree because we want to raise awareness to breast cancer, and we'll be doing that, I'm sure, again today. This day in medicine, October 26, 1877, Dr. Joseph Lister repairs and wires a fractured kneecap using antisepsis. Now, we talk a lot about Dr. Lister, and really, you know, and if there were ever a great name for a product, it would have been Listerine. Dr. Joseph Lister, we talk a lot about him because we really try to remember his accomplishment really in getting us to sterile surgery. Don't forget, surgery back then did not have these sterile techniques and antisepsis, so you were seeing a lot of infections. And just think of how many lives have been saved just by moving really starting a movement towards antisepsis and how that has evolved. So, as always, today we remember Dr. Joseph Lister. Many of you are hearing about the E. coli outbreak. This has been going on for weeks now. It specifically has affected McDonald's the most, and specifically the Quarter Pounder. I don't even know how they can focus it down to one product. You are seeing it in other manufacturers, but all the cases have been reported through McDonald's. And when I say other manufacturers, they have nailed down where the E. coli is coming from. It's coming from onions, the raw onions that are put on the burgers. And now 75 individuals in 13 states have been affected by this, and there has been one fatality. So again, you know, this speaks to the safety of our food resources. I don't remember ever hearing about this stuff in the past, and yet we're hearing more and more about it. Is it because we have better ways of detecting it? People were just becoming sick in the past, and we just said it was food poisoning. But now we have enough sophistication to really trace things back not only to the product, but the manufacturer and what it was put in. But despite that, we need to really inspect the places that prepare our food. This is a vulnerable area to us, And it really is the USDA and the FDA that really have to be our eyes and ears in this regard. And we're going to continue to follow this because this is not an outbreak to be taken lightly. There's a new study that was just published on helmet use in motorcycles. Now, many people will know this is kind of a pet peeve of mine. But when these studies come up, they just reinforce again the need for wearing a helmet on a motorcycle. In the latest study from the Institute for Highway Safety, they found that stricter state road safety laws from 1976 to 2022 would have saved 22,058 motorcyclist lives. That's how many lives could have been saved in that period of time. Now, it only represents 11% of all motorcycle rider fatalities. So there have been a lot of fatalities on motorcycles. But what's shocking to me, and I didn't realize this, that only 17 states and the District of Columbia have strong helmet laws, of which we here in Connecticut are not one of them. And guess what? There's a reason why when you turn on TV, right, and you see attorneys all saying, well, we ride and we understand riders. That's because so many riders are getting hurt. And these are tragic cases because they often involve young people who are on out there trying to have a safe ride, enjoy their motorcycle. And to be quite honest with you, wearing a helmet is kind of comfortable. You know, I started wearing a helmet on a bicycle, and when I ski, I mean, it's part of what we do. It's become part of the fabric. In certain sports now, we're seeing more and more helmet use. We're seeing, you know, specialized helmet use even in football that people are talking about. But here we are, people who are on a high-velocity vehicle not wearing a helmet. What's also interesting in my travels to Europe this summer, helmet laws are uniform throughout Europe. They wear helmets. They don't necessarily wear them on bicycles, but they certainly wear them on motorcycles, and it's the law in European. In the, I think it's probably throughout the European Union. I don't think I've ever seen somebody on a motorcycle there in my travels not wearing a helmet. So maybe we could wake up our state leaders here in Connecticut. I know they're all afraid they'll lose votes from motorcyclists and everybody's out there without their helmet on, but isn't safety really a priority here? And it's an expense to all of us if you're worried about expenses, because it goes well beyond a level of insurance when these folks are hurt. So let's keep that in mind as we come up on this election year and how we're going to shape our society in this state and really lead rather than follow others. Another thing that's come up in the world of sports, we're all hearing about the transfer portal. We're talking a lot about NIL, which is the name, image, and likeness money being paid to college athletes and high school athletes. You know, I don't have a problem with athletes making money. I just don't. And even at that level, from the standpoint that if you're going to use their name, image, and likeness, you should be ready to pay for it. And that's part of a free market, whether it comes to shoes, clothes, any other kind of advertising. But I think a line has been crossed. And let me explain. There are certain health products out there that are unproven in terms of safety, and especially in the area of concussion where I'm involved. So there are products out there that, and they're products that we test, and the testing goes on. But some products fail that in the sense that they do not provide what they advocate to do. So, and they're very expensive. So what they do is they go around the science, right? Go around the reports. Let's go use a pull strategy, go right to the parents. So what they're doing is getting amateur athletes to wear their product, even knowing that it doesn't necessarily help, and they will pay that athlete to wear that product so that they can get other people to use it. I don't have a problem with that other than the fact that it's a safety issue. It's a health issue now. And what's happened, actually, in the athletes that I've had contact with who have done this, the product itself served as so much of a distraction to them, they took the darn thing off, and I guess they're going to do without the money. But the point here is this is not the Wild West, and there need to be lines drawn as to how you're going to advertise and what types of products are going to be advertised by athletes to get others to buy it, get parents. What parent wouldn't buy something that makes their child safer? But by the same token, these things should, before people shell out good money for this, they should be tested and proven before we do that. All right, we're going to take a short break. Then we're going to be back with my guest, Dr. Kate Capasso. We're talking about breast cancer today. What I'd like you to do is you can reach out to me at info@alessimd.com with any questions you have for my guest or for me during the show. I'm happy to bring them up. So questions about breast cancer, just bring them on over. You're listening to Healthy Rounds on WTIC News Talk 1080. We're back on Healthy Rounds. I'm your host, Dr. Anthony Alessi, and it's great to be with you again on this Saturday morning. My guest today is Dr. Kate Capasso. She is a board-certified general surgeon and specializes in breast cancer treatment and surgery. She is at St. Francis Hospital, and she has been very kind to join us this morning. Kate, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me on. I'm excited to be here.
Well, let's talk a little bit about you. So tell us a little bit about your background, what brought you to St. Francis Hospital, and what brought you to your specialty.
Sure. So I am initially from Southern Connecticut. I'm from Fairfield County. I did most of my studying outside of Connecticut. So I did my undergraduate work at Villanova. I went to Albany Medical College for my medical degree. And then I did my training back down in Philadelphia at Einstein Medical Center. And then I finished with my fellowship in breast surgical oncology up at Beth Israel Deaconess in Boston. I've been with the team at St. Francis for about a year now. It's truly an exceptional team. You know, we have a wonderful comprehensive breast center that is really providing cutting-edge care to our breast patients, and I'm just so excited to be a part of the team here.
I'm glad you brought that up. So let's talk about the team. So who are the other members of the team, and what makes up a breast cancer center such as the one at St. Francis?
Sure. So our breast center and breast centers in general really offer comprehensive breast care, and we have providers here with expertise dedicated to breast cancer and breast cancer patients. So we have our breast surgeons here at the breast center who are seeing and evaluating our breast cancer patients and also our patients who are at high risk of breast cancer. So we really do provide comprehensive breast care to our community. We also have dedicated breast radiologists who are fellowship trained in breast radiology, and they bring their expertise to work every day in determining what additional workup patients need if any imaging studies identify abnormalities. We have our breast pathologists who are trained in looking at our surgical specimens, and we also have our medical oncologists and radiation oncologists who, again, also specialize in breast cancer care. So we really have a comprehensive team, again, who are dedicated to our breast cancer patients.
Has patients accessing breast centers like the one at St. Francis pretty much become the rule now rather than the exception in terms of breast care and the standard of care?
I think so. I think what has been so interesting in kind of seeing this, you know, field of breast surgery evolve throughout the years is that I feel like now everywhere you look, there's a new breast cancer center, and it's really become a collaborative, multidisciplinary team effort in taking care of breast cancer patients, which I think is so important and so wonderful to have the whole team's input when, you know, assessing our patients and coming up with a treatment plan.
But here's a question. When people are looking for a breast center, right, in terms of, because It's a commitment on the part of the patient as well as the physicians. What should they be looking for when a patient, before they decide they've reached this diagnosis of breast cancer, want to go to a breast center, but as you said, they're cropping up all over the place. So what makes one better than another for a patient who is searching for a breast center?
I think it's really important to take a look at the whole team. Again, we want to make sure that we have our dedicated breast radiologists who are bringing their expertise to analyzing the breast imaging and making sure that we are, you know, accurately interpreting the imaging and making sure that we're treating everything appropriately. We also want to make sure that we have our breast surgeons. There's been a push sort of through the field of general surgery to now have breast surgical oncologists who are trained in breast surgery, and I think they can just bring some cutting-edge techniques, some new technology to breast cancer care as well. So I think that's also really important. And then just taking a look at the rest of the team. So again, here at St. Francis, we're so lucky. We have our medical oncologists and radiation oncologists who are dedicated in breast. And I think just having a whole team that really focuses on that makes sure that you're getting up-to-date care from the whole team.
Is there a central location for the team?
So most of us are located here at Hartford, at the main St. Francis Hospital in the Comprehensive Women's Center and in the Smilo Cancer Center. But we also, here at the Breast Surgery Office, we do have some satellite locations in Glastonbury and Enfield. And so that provides a little bit more convenience for patients. But the whole team is generally centralized here at St. Francis.
Okay, excellent. That's I really think that's important for our listeners to know. Let's get on to a little bit about breast cancer statistics. Where are we in this whole picture of breast cancer? Have we been making progress?
I think we've been making progress in terms of treatment and overall survival. So I think our numbers are really excellent for those areas. I pulled some numbers from the National Cancer Institute, and so overall five-year survival is about 91%. So that's really high, and that's really, really good. Of course, we still have room to improve, and that's one of the things I love about this field is we're always evolving and always pushing the research to make sure that we can really optimize these outcomes. And I think in terms of new cases, you know, breast cancer is still a huge cancer diagnosed for women worldwide. So worldwide, there were about 2.26 million breast cancer cases and about 685,000 deaths. And here in the U.S., specifically for 2024, our projected numbers include about 310,000 new cases and 42,000 deaths. So I think overall, for overall survival, again, we're doing really well, but we still have room to improve.
Is that across all types of breast cancer?
That is.
Okay. I wasn't sure if they were looking at a specific cell type. So it seems like we have had an effect on the numbers overall. What do you think has been the biggest push in terms of, you mentioned treatment, but is it awareness, testing? What do you think has affected a change the most?
I think it's a combination of several factors. So the American College of Radiology has estimated that screening mammography has decreased breast cancer mortality by 40% since 1990, and I think that's huge. That's not a really long time interval to see that huge change. So I think that push for annual screening mammograms has been really instrumental in early detection, which is when we can, you know, affect the most change in terms of treatment. And I also think there has been a huge push for breast cancer awareness. And, you know, especially throughout the month of October, you know, I feel like there are breast cancer awareness events everywhere, which I think is so important to getting the word out so that women can, you know, be proactive in making sure they're up to date with their screening mammograms.
What we're going to do is take a short break. I have so many more questions here for Dr. Capasso. We're talking about breast cancer awareness, and some new diagnostic and treatment tests, treatments for breast cancer. If you wish to reach out for me, you can just reach me at info@alessimd.com, and I'm glad to and very happy to pose those questions for Dr. Capasso. So we're going to take a short break, then we'll be back with more information. You're listening to Healthy Rounds on WTIC, News Talk 1080. We're back on Healthy Rounds. I'm your host, Dr. Anthony Alessi, and my guest today is Dr. Kate Capasso, and we are discussing breast cancer and breast cancer treatments. We've just had a great discussion on breast centers, such as the one at St. Francis Hospital. As a reminder, if you wish to reach out to Dr. Capasso, the best phone number is 860-714-9729. Kate, we were talking a little bit about breast cancer statistics and awareness. Has a lot of the awareness, you know, wearing pink and athletes wearing pink, has that really affected a change, in your opinion?
I think it has. I see a lot of patients who, you know, come in for a high-risk assessment or they want to get their breast health checked because they see things in the media. For example, you know, I feel like we have a lot of celebrities like Angelina Jolie, for example, that was found to have the BRCA gene and underwent her prophylactic surgery. And we have some other celebrities that are dealing with their breast cancer diagnosis. And so I feel like that just all helps to increase awareness and really get our patients taken care of.
Why are we now seeing more cases in young women? When I look at the statistics, we've done great with with older women, but why are we seeing, are we just recognizing it more in younger women? Have changes in the mammography or getting earlier mammograms? What is it? Why are we seeing more cases in young women?
I think it's a combination of factors. And I just want to preface this answer by saying that this is still an area of ongoing research. I think nationally we're seeing more cancers diagnosed in younger people. Another area that this is currently being studied in is colon cancer as well. But I think there are some things that have led to this being found in younger women. Here in the state of Connecticut, we're so lucky that we not only offer annual screening mammograms, but if a patient is found to have dense breast tissue, then we also obtain a screening ultrasound, which can improve breast cancer detection rates. And so, you know, sometimes we see this cancer that was detected on ultrasound that was missed on mammography because of dense breast tissue. So I think that is an adjunct that has been helping detect this earlier in younger women. I think also, you know, the American Cancer Society has been looking at this specifically and has attributed this in part due to overall decreasing birth rates in the U.S. We know that pregnancy and breastfeeding are protective factors for breast cancer. So, you know, nationally, as we tend to wait a little bit to have children, sometimes that can affect our breast cancer rates. And also just a generalized increase in obesity could also be influencing some of those increased breast cancer rates.
Well, the idea of having children at a later age, I never really thought of that. That's an outstanding point there. Let's talk a little bit. We've touched a little bit on diagnosis. Is mammography still the go-to test in screening for breast cancer?
Mammography is still the gold standard. Several of our societies, including the American Society of Breast Surgeons, recommends that all women start getting their annual screening mammograms every year, starting at the age of 40 if you're at average risk. And we always tailor that a little bit depending on patient's family history. So if someone is found to be at higher risk where they have a very strong family history, I would encourage them to talk to their provider to make sure that they're getting their screening starting at an appropriate age.
And when you say an appropriate age, so you're thinking that people who are at higher risk or with a family history should start when? Age 35? Do they start that young?
It depends on their family history. So we usually say 10 years before the youngest family member was diagnosed with breast cancer. So if they had someone in their family diagnosed at age 40, then we would recommend starting screening at age 30.
Okay. Again, another rule I've never heard, and that's very important to know. Let's talk a little bit about MRI. Now, what's the succession of things? So if you see something suspicious on a mammogram, then you go to ultrasound, go to MRI. How does that work out?
So if we see something suspicious on a screening mammogram, and the goal of the screening mammogram is to pick up any abnormalities, our next steps are usually a diagnostic mammogram, so taking some additional pictures, specifically looking at the area of concern, and also an ultrasound to see if we can see anything abnormal on the ultrasound. Sometimes we can, but sometimes there is no correlate for the mammographic finding on the ultrasound, and then that will determine the need for a biopsy and additional workup from there.
Is there a fair, and I'm being somewhat critical here, but is there a fair amount of confusion in terms of things you see that are relevant, not relevant? I mean, as soon as you tell a woman there's something on a mammogram, right, that's going to raise an issue. And, you know, and sometimes it's benign. Sometimes you can't resolve it. How do you work through that? I mean, that's got to be tough.
It is tricky. I think this is where having those dedicated breast radiologists really comes into play, because they're taking all of their expertise and experience into analyzing these images to make sure that we're getting an appropriate outcome. But one thing unique to breast imaging is that we have this particular scoring system. It's called the BI-RADS score. And so at the end of every imaging report, you'll see a BI-RADS score, and that tells us what to do next. So, for example, if we have a BI-RADS 1, that's a negative image or nothing concerning, we can go on to our annual screening. If we have a BI-RADS 2, that's a benign finding. So, for example, if we have a simple cyst, we would get a BI-RADS 2. If we have a BI-RADS 3, it means that we see something there, less than a 2% chance that that's a cancer. And so we usually recommend follow-up imaging in about 6 months. And then a BI-RADS 4 and BI-RADS 5 lesions, we're more concerned that this potentially could be a cancer. And so those patients usually go on for a biopsy. So having those scoring systems, I think, is really helpful for determining additional workup for these patients and kind of what to do next.
I have an interesting question, actually a situation sent to me by John, and I want to read it to you. We recently had a 35-year-old family member, a nephew, be diagnosed with breast cancer. The cancer is attributed to a generation-skipping gene from his father's mother. So maternal grandmother had ovarian cancer. It was found via persistent pulled muscle feeling in his chest. Treatment was chemotherapy and mastectomy to clear margins with radiation follow-up. They'd like to know if you would share a few words on the topic of men with breast cancer.
Yeah, so men with breast cancer, you know, overall it is pretty rare, but there were about 3,000 cases of men with breast cancer over the past year, so it's definitely something that we see. Breast cancer in men is usually treated very similar to breast cancer in women, so it's going to be really important to take a look at what kind of cancer, what those receptors are, to determine the benefits of chemotherapy. And then for surgery, you know, we usually recommend a mastectomy, which it sounds like this patient had. And then, you know, radiation is influenced by, again, the type of cancer and where it's located. So overall, it is treated pretty similarly to women, but it is overall rather rare. And so, you know, I think it's still important to have, you know, awareness in the community that this could still happen to men and that we need to be aware of that.
Age 35, that sounds pretty young. Do you generally see it in younger men?
You know, I think it's, you know, overall pretty similar population to women, and that usually we see it in older men, but we are starting to see more cancers in younger people in general. And so I think some of the more recent male breast cancer patients that I can think of off the top of my head, they were also young as well. And it sounds like, you know, here it was attributed to a cancer gene. And so we know that that can also be a cause for early onset cancer.
Let's move on to treatment. So surgery, chemotherapy, radiation. What has changed in terms of surgery? We heard, I mean, I trained in the area of radical mastectomies, which you don't really hear a lot about of now, and lumpectomy. Can you talk a little bit about the different surgical approaches to breast cancer?
Sure. So for breast cancer surgery, I want to break it down into two parts. The first part is addressing the breast, and the second part is addressing the lymph nodes in the axilla or under the arm on the same side as the breast cancer. So for the breast part of the operation, we can either do a lumpectomy, which you mentioned, which is just taking out the cancer with normal breast tissue surrounding it, so we have a negative margin. That lumpectomy is usually coupled with radiation therapy, which occurs postoperatively. So a lumpectomy plus radiation therapy is something called breast conservation. And the other option is a mastectomy, or complete removal of the breast. And like you mentioned, we don't do those radical mastectomies anymore, and so we're just taking the breast tissue but leaving the chest muscles intact. And then for the lymph node part of the surgery, We usually do something called a sentinel lymph node biopsy. So we used to take all the lymph nodes under the arm, regardless, and that, you know, increases the risk of complications. But now we can just check a couple lymph nodes or those sentinel lymph nodes, and that decreases the risk of complications and morbidity for the patient.
When you go past that now, and we're talking about chemotherapy, has that changed very much?
So, over the course of the last few years, we've tried to even de-escalate chemotherapy even more. And so not everyone who has breast cancer needs chemotherapy. That depends a little bit on the type of breast cancer, on the receptors, where it's located. And then now, depending on the type of cancer, we can send a special test on the tumor. It's called an oncotype test. It looks at the genetics of that particular tumor and gives us the benefit of chemotherapy for that patient. And so I think that's a really important tool that we use. Instead of just treating everyone the same, you know, we're really tailoring treatment to the patient to ensure that they have the most benefit from their treatment.
You know, we hear a lot about personalized medicine, and I think that what you're describing is the same to some extent. But in particular, in some cancers, they're able to take some of the tissue and create a vaccine, for lack of a better term, in terms of immunotherapy. Has that been tried, or is it under trial for breast cancers?
I think it's something that we're always trying to push the envelope and work on. I don't have anything that is, you know, FDA approved or the mainstay of treatment as of yet. But we do have some immunotherapy medications that target specific receptors on the breast cancer. So for example, the HER2 protein is something that we test for in our breast cancers, and we do have medications targeted to that particular protein. And so if someone is found to be HER2 positive, and this was a huge development in the field of medical oncology for breast cancer, we can target that particular protein and really improve outcomes.
You know, being an older physician and looking back at breast cancer from when I was a student in the 70s, I'm just amazed at how far we've come and the things you're describing. I mean, to the point where, breast cancer treatment then was radical mastectomy, right? Taking the breast, muscle, all the lymph nodes. And everybody got the same chemotherapy and everybody got the same radiation. So it's heartwarming for me to see how much this field has evolved to be so personalized. And even in the case that John mentioned in terms of radiation treatment, can you talk a little bit about how radiation has changed in terms of treatment of breast cancer?
Sure. So I mentioned that radiation usually goes hand in hand with a lumpectomy, and that's usually radiation to the whole breast, and then delivering a little bit of a boost to where the tumor was. But we've even pushed the envelope on radiation. So for some patients, you know, who are over a certain age with a very small tumor that's hormone receptor positive, sometimes we're able to omit radiation completely, which is huge. Again, we're pushing the envelope on improving outcomes while, you know, trying to minimize interventions and toxicity to the patient. So I think, you know, throughout the whole field of breast cancer care, like you mentioned, you know, we're really trying to tailor care to the patient and to the type of cancer that they have.
You know, one thing we haven't talked about is the types of breast cancer. Can you talk a little bit about those in terms of the more malignant, fewer malignant? We hear a lot about intraductal tumors and scoring of those. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. So we have something called ductal carcinoma in situ, which I tell my patients is a pre-invasive cancer or a stage zero cancer. And so that's where we have cancer cells within the breast ducts, but they haven't come out of the breast ducts into the surrounding breast tissue. And so that's a stage zero breast cancer. Right now, it's still treated very much like a regular invasive breast cancer, but there are some ongoing studies looking at trying to de-escalate treatment for that. And then we move into our invasive cancers, and there are many different types, but the two most common are something called an invasive ductal carcinoma and an invasive lobular carcinoma, and those are just determined based on how the cells are growing under the microscope, and the pathologists take a look at that and let us know. And then we also take a look at the receptors for all of our breast cancers. And so we're looking at the estrogen receptor, the progesterone receptor, and the HER2 protein. And those, again, give us some information in terms of how best to treat it and what medications we can use to target those specific receptors.
Does that include the adenocarcinomas?
Yes. So that would be like an invasive ductal and an invasive lobular. Those would be adenocarcinomas. Yep.
Okay. Okay.
Yep.
So where have you had the most success in treatment, and which types?
I think what's really exciting looking at now would be that ductal carcinoma in situ, or that pre-invasive cancer. So right now it's treated very much like an invasive cancer. So we do surgery, sometimes, you know, anti-estrogen therapy if it's hormone receptor positive, and radiation therapy. But we have a current study nationally that's looking at trying to just treat that with hormone therapy alone, and trying to eliminate the surgery and radiation piece. So I think that's really exciting. We might be able to de-escalate treatment for that as well. And then for the invasive ductals and invasive lobulars, you know, I think what's really exciting is that, again, treatment is really tailored to the type of tumor the patient has, and trying to, you know, maximize their overall outcome by minimizing interventions, if that makes sense.
It does. It does, because it sounds like we're figuring how to be less aggressive and still get a great outcome, which I think is phenomenal. My next question is, so when should a patient, both male or female, be alarmed about breast cancer? From the standpoint of, some people have said self-examination doesn't really help, does help. I'm a proponent of self-examination for many things, because I think it empowers patients. But that being aside, what should people be doing to be, other than getting the mammograms, to be more alert to the possibilities of breast cancer? And I bring it up because there's a lot of misinformation out there, right? I've heard the stories of people who have said, well, I have a lump, but it hurts, so if it hurts, it can't be cancer. So can we dispel some of that and maybe empower some of our listeners today?
Absolutely. I agree with you. I think self-exams are so important. A lot of times patients come in because they felt something or they noticed something, and so they're really their best advocate. So I agree with you. Self-exams are so important. I recommend that patients do them every month around the same time. So if a patient is still getting their monthly cycle, then it's best to do it about a week or two after the cycle finishes. But if you're no longer getting your monthly cycle, then just doing it the same time every month. So sometimes the first of the month is a good time to try to remember to do it. And things that you want to look for would be any new skin changes, any new skin dimpling, or areas where the skin just looks like it's pulling in a little bit. If you notice any swelling, either in the breast or under the arm on either side, any new lumps or bumps, any nipple discharge, anything like that would really prompt evaluation with your provider. And to your second point, at least I was taught in medical school that cancer usually doesn't cause any pain, but I think that's not true. Sometimes we have patients coming in because they felt a new painful lump. That's the first thing that kicks off this screening workup that finds their breast cancer. So I would say any abnormal signs, symptoms, anything of concern that a patient feels, you know, please call your provider, come to our breast center. It's always better to get evaluated early. Again, that way, if, you know, it is a breast cancer, we can take care of it early and improve the outcomes.
As a final question, what's something that our listeners need to know that they may not know right now in terms of either the future of breast cancer treatment or something they should be more aware of?
That's a good question. I think the big future of breast cancer treatment is, again, something that we've kind of touched on throughout this conversation, but just really that we're trying to de-escalate care while maintaining exceptional outcomes, and we're really tailoring our treatment to every patient. And so, sometimes I hear from patients that, you know, so-and-so had this type of breast cancer. Is it the same as mine? And, you know, it's not. Every breast cancer is different. Every patient is different. And so every treatment plan might just be a little bit different. So I think it's, you know, important to make sure you're you know, you're getting the most up-to-date information in terms of that. And then the last thing I'll leave patients with is just a really good resource that I really like. It's a website called breast360.org. It's written by breast surgeons. So, of course, I'm biased, but it has a lot of really good information about all things breast. So it has a lot of breast cancer treatment, but also it has information about screening, screening imaging, recommendations, and patients who are at higher risk. So I think it gives some really good articles and topics to research more if anyone is interested, and some, you know, some good resources for them.
Kate, thank you. Thank you for your time today, and thank you for everything you do for our community. Really appreciate your time.
Thank you so much for having me on. I appreciate it.
Thank you. We're going to take a short break, then I'm going to be back with the closing message. You're listening to Healthy Rounds on WTIC News Talk 1080. We're back on Healthy Rounds. And I wanted to leave a closing message for today, and that is right now there are many issues facing Americans with this upcoming presidential election. And when there are a lot of issues, I try to go with what I know best and what I have the best knowledge of. And in that case, it's neurology. Previously, we had two candidates, both exhibiting signs of cognitive impairment. You might say, well, how do you know that? Well, there are certain signs that you look for as a neurologist. You look at alterations of gait, difficulties going up an incline, down an incline. You look for run-on sentences, frequently relating to people from the past, where a candidate may lose their train of thought frequently, not be able to respond to a question. We're now left with only one candidate who continues to exhibit those features of mental impairment. Sometimes he refers to him as a weave, but those of us who have worked with patients who have cognitive impairment know that that weave is just a way of delaying or trying to remember what the question was. I have to be honest with you. What I know best is cognitive impairment. And I, for one, will not entrust the safety and the health of myself and my family to anyone who is mentally impaired. With that, I urge you all to vote. I urge you all to take your own expertise, whether it be history, economics, military, and apply it, because there are a lot of confusing messages out there. So take what you know best and take that to the ballot box with you. With that, I thank Dr. Capasso for her time today. And as always, I thank Kevin Corza, who's been on the board. Next up on WTIC is Law Talk with Attorney John Matulis. Until next week, this is Dr. Anthony Alessi. Please stay healthy.
This has been Healthy Rounds with Dr. Anthony Alessi, sponsored by Hartford HealthCare, Rochford Eye Center, St. Francis Hospital, Covaris, and UConn Health Orthopedics and Sports Medicine. Be sure to tune in next Saturday morning at 11 for more Healthy Rounds on WTIC News Talk 1080 and WTIC.com. Till then, stay well.